The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0. Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
All right, welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show and Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. You can find me at mojo50.com or online at mikeonline.com. That's the Mike Gallagher website. Thanks to Salem Media for giving me the platform for my podcast. So you can always find the podcast there. If you enjoy it, you want to share it with friends, it is free. So go to the website, mikeonline.com, and share the show. Also, be sure to go over to Facebook to the official Sam Sorbo Facebook page and check in there, because I do update stuff over there. We're going to talk today about the walkaway movement, hashtag walkaway. Is it a hoax? I've got some insider information on that. Also, the European court has now approved deportations. This is a big turn, and Bloomberg's in the news more and more, but it's not all good. But hey, folks, before I get to all of that, my guest is here to talk about his new book, Eavesdropping on Lucifer. How's that for an engaging title? And also the over 2,000 aborted human infant bodies that were buried in Mayor Pete Buttigieg's hometown of South Bend, Indiana. I'm sure that story didn't escape you. Don Stenberg served as Attorney General of the great state of Nebraska, and he is now promoting a book called Eavesdropping on Lucifer. It's his most recent book. It's scheduled to be released in May, but we snagged an interview with him before then. So welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So your book deals with this whole cultural thing that we're seeing, and it's a shift, wouldn't you say?
Well, yes, the culture has changed dramatically, I think, as we've all witnessed in the last 40 or 50 years. We've gone to abortion on demand. We've seen Ten Commandment monuments taken down by court order. Seen Christianity referred to as a religion of hate. We've seen Christian bakers and florists punished by the government for refusing to participate in same-sex marriages. And my new book, Eavesdropping on Lucifer, offers an easy understanding of how this happened and hope for the future. It's a little bit like C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters, because the explanation of the expansion of evil in Eavesdropping on Lucifer comes from Lucifer himself, as he interviews a would-be apprentice. And he talks about how difficult it's been to change the culture, but that he's been very happy. And then he sends his apprentice out to do various evil things, and God's angel Angelica comes on the scene in several occasions and prevents some of that evil. So it's a fictional book, but it deals with a lot of current cultural issues and how some of these things came to happen.
So Screwtape Letters is one of my all-time favorite books. And if you haven't read it, this is just to my audience. If you haven't read it, the audiobook recording is phenomenal. And so I highly recommend it for listening in your car or wherever you listen to audiobooks. And so this one sounds really great, Eavesdropping on Lucifer, which, of course, is your book. It comes out in May. But is it appropriate for younger people? Like, is there an age limit for it? Because Screwtape Letters is assigned in high school. Well, I homeschool, so it's assigned for homeschoolers in high school many times. Would this book be sort of in that class?
I think it would be very appropriate for high school. In fact, former U.S. Attorney John Ashcroft has read an advanced copy of the book and And what he has had to say about it, he says, quote, eavesdropping on Lucifer is common sense, digestible wisdom that can be easily understood by every generation. C.S. Lewis would have given it his stamp of approval. So that's, that's former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft. And he's really a very, very fine man, very strong religious faith. And so I really appreciated his endorsement of eavesdropping on Lucifer.
Nice. All right. Now I'm going to ask you maybe a little bit of a tougher question. Because I just want to sort of give you the opportunity to refute this, but the pushback is, well, okay, so the devil's got his foothold, and what do we do about that? Right? If we're going to just sort of blame the devil and go about our business, isn't that a little bit of an abdication?
Well, it could be if you take that approach. One of the things in the book that comes up repeatedly is Lucifer, who's called the boss in the book, is frequently complaining about how difficult his job is because anyone who asks the son for forgiveness for whatever evil he or she has done is saved. And so the underlying theme in the book is salvation through God's Son. And of course, the devil complains about this frequently in the book, that it just makes his job so much more difficult.
Right. So, okay. So then let's talk about the culture at large. You said that there's been a transition over the past, I think you said 50 or 60 years, 40 or 50, somewhere in there. What caused that? What is that?
Well, it's, of course, in the book, Lucifer takes credit for that. And, you know, the devil is sometimes thought of by people as a scary guy, which probably in his own realm he is. But the methods used are things that sound desirable. For example, there's the discussion of how the breakdown of the family has occurred and how the tremendous increase in the number of divorces and how that came about, which was the no-fault divorce, which was sold as a big improvement on how things would be done. And yet the result of that, along with some government policies, for welfare and so forth, have actually encouraged divorce and the breakdown of the family. And then, of course, the breakdown of the family has led to more use of illegal drugs, more young people getting into trouble with the law. And the statistics are just overwhelming that children who grow up in a family without a father are much more likely to have problems with drugs and illegal activities and
right.
And psychological problems and so forth.
Right. So, but what precipitated that? And how? So obviously the idea is we need to fight back against this. Does the book offer an answer? Is it just, I guess if it's just a work of fiction, maybe that wasn't your goal. Your goal was just to sort of elucidate the problem.
Well, it was. And then to reiterate, individual salvation through God's Son. And there's also a few chapters about creation science that tend to prove the creation story in the Bible. Discussion of you may be familiar with this since you studied biomedical engineering, but the microbial Eve, the studies that have shown that every woman on the planet has descended from one single female ancestor, and that's strictly based on science. So we get into a little bit of science, mm-hmm. as well as, of course, the legal system deals a little bit with what the U.S. Supreme Court, some of their decisions have adversely impacted our culture.
Right. I personally put it all down to education. I think that's the root of all of it. So, but that's my take because I'm all about education these days, because the problem is that you cannot see something other than the way that you've been taught to look at it. And so if you've had teachers who've taught you to look at things through a certain lens, and they do, and they have, very difficult. This is the objection that many parents have to homeschooling their children, is that their first objection is, I don't know how. Because they've been taught that they don't know anything that they haven't been formally educated on. And the sadness is all evidence to the contrary. People are doing things every day that they've not had formal training on, that they've learned themselves.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. And education is critical. The book touches on that. I might add that I have a son and daughter-in-law with seven kids there in California that are homeschooling their children because they're concerned about the public schools, and another daughter here in Nebraska who's homeschooling their kids as well because of concerns
about
what's being taught in the public schools.
I love that you use the word concerns. Like, it's so much more than a concern, but great, you know, whatever floats their boat, whatever gets them out of that institution and gets the kids at home with their parents, which is really where they belong. That's the only way to preserve the family relationship. Home education is so much more than education, although it certainly encompasses education, but the purpose for home education, and they will realize that as time goes on. They'll say, well, the benefits are so much more than just my kids tend to be smarter and more knowledgeable and more equipped, right? You know, our schools say college prep and career readiness. Again, all evidence to the contrary. It's a Ponzi scheme. Go ahead.
Well, you're absolutely right. And on standardized tests as a group, and of course, the individual exception, but as a group, homeschooled students tend to do better on standardized tests than folks who go to go to public schools. And I think people who haven't been involved in homeschooling may not be aware that there's all kinds of help out there in terms of curriculum that's available, both online and offline, that can help you with the education of your children if you need that sort of help.
Right. And the reason that you need that sort of help is because you've been taught that you need that sort of help. It's like a vicious cycle. But,
well, it is. It is.
Yeah. But the fact is, there is a great deal of support now. In fact, this week I'm participating in a homeschool expo online. It's called the Homegrown Generation Online Family Expo. And so all week this week, there are speakers over at Homegrown Generation Online Family Expo. If you go to their website, you can sign up. And I'm actually appearing at the end of the week. And it's just a resource for families to go check out, you know, what are my options? What's available to me? Lots of curriculum talk, lots of talk about just how to get it done and stuff. What happens to a homeschool parent is they think that they should sort of recreate the school environment at home. But the reason that they're leaving the schools is because not just concerns over what's happening in the schools, but what's not happening in the schools, namely education, is not happening in the schools. And so if you're going to try to do it yourself, please don't try to recreate what they do in school, because they're failing and it's not being successful. So try something different. And I mean, this nation was founded on self-educated entrepreneurs. And that's where we need to go. We need to get back to that.
Well, that's great. Yeah. And for example, public schools, a lot of them are teaching very little of our American history, the founding principles of our nation, structure of government, and the religious foundations of our nation, which I also touch on in eavesdropping on Lucifer. It's almost impossible to believe, but Harvard and Yale, for example, were founded for the purpose of training clergy and required Bible reading every day and so on and so forth. And so our nation has changed very greatly, and some of what kids should be taught in school, they're not. And you can do that in your home school.
Well, it sounds like a great book, Eavesdropping on Lucifer. It'll be available in May, so we're a little bit early. But you can, I'm sure, pre-order, because you wouldn't be doing this if you can't pre-order the book. Eavesdropping on Lucifer. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a website too, eavesdroppingonlucifer.com, and you can pre-order the book on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. And the e-book should be out in a couple of weeks.
That's fantastic. So Eavesdropping on Lucifer, and I just want to thank you so much for coming on and just speaking frankly. Before I let you go, I teased that we were going to talk about what happened in Indiana. And I know that you were as horrified as I was when we discovered this, but what's being done? Like, what's the next step?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, I think ultimately, I'm optimistic that we can see Roe versus Wade overturned so that states will be free to enact regulations or prohibitions on these sorts of things. I think that right now we probably have five Supreme Court justices who believe that Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided. Mm-hmm. But I think that before they will take a case that they could use to overturn Roe versus Wade, they would like to have at least six justices to have a decision that wouldn't be overturned again with another change in the justice. So I do think that if President Trump has the opportunity to replace one more of the liberal pro-abortion judges on the U.S. Supreme Court with a constitutional conservative, that the stage will be set for a case that would could be brought to the court to overturn Roe versus Wade and return these decisions to our elected representatives.
But for the time being, those babies, and the mothers. Imagine if he was your doctor and you just, I mean, I know some of the people don't care, but I know so many women who went through an abortion and regret it. This has to be deeply, deeply unsettling.
Yeah. I mean, to keep that, to have medically preserved baby bodies in your garage is just so incredibly horrifying and inhumane that it's almost impossible to comprehend. And it's somewhat similar to the case I argued in the U.S. Supreme Court in Stenberg versus Carhart, partial birth abortion case. And partial birth abortion, a baby is born up to its head, so the rest of its body is outside the mother, and then the child's brains are removed and the delivery is completed. And that was such a horrifying procedure that 30 states passed laws banning it in the mid to late 1990s.
And can I just say, I'm sorry to do this, but I have to say, the brains are removed so that the head collapses to make the delivery more easy.
That's exactly right. And it's just horrifying that you've got a baby that's moving around and
yeah.
do that.
Yeah.
Sadly, we lost that one 5-4, but then Justice O'Connor was replaced with Justice Alito, and another case was brought, this time by the United States government under George Bush. And in that case, the court found that you could ban partial birth abortions on a 5-4 decision. So I'm optimistic for the future on this, if we can get one more constitutional conservative to the U.S. Supreme Court, because a lot of legal scholars agree there's no real constitutional basis for Roe versus Wade in the first place.
In the first place, that's my problem, is I don't know where in the Constitution it says the federal government should make medical decisions or whatever you would want to call it. It seems like an overreach anyway.
Well, that's right. There's nothing in the Constitution, so they make it up. The penumbra of rights that emanate from the Constitution. So that's, you know, they're making it up when they can't point to any provision of the Constitution.
Yeah, same thing with health care, by the way. They had to find some weird workaround that it's across the state border trade so that they could somehow advocate for Obamacare. By the way, how about that State of the Union where Trump highlighted the baby born at 21 weeks, 5 days?
Yeah, it's amazing what medical. Yeah, it's amazing what medical science can do, and yet we see you know, there's a bill in the U.S. Congress, U.S. Senate, actually a Nebraska U.S. senator who goes to the same church I do has a bill to prohibit the killing of a baby who survives an abortion, which you would think everybody would want. Preserve the life of a baby who has actually been born, and yet many of the pro-abortion folks in the Congress can't even support that. So it's really a sad situation.
Folks, my guest is Don Stenberg. He's the author of Eavesdropping on Lucifer. It does seem an outrage. And so the bigger cultural question that, of course, this is addressing is the sanctity of human life. Are human lives valuable or are they statistics? And I would posit to you that the left thinks of human life as completely expendable and a statistic. And the right, and certainly Christianity, values each individual human life as an individual sovereign being. And so when you take a 30,000 foot view of this, you have to understand that by supporting abortion, and certainly by supporting this, the partial birth abortion and abortion post delivery and all of that, what you're supporting is a dismembering of human sovereignty. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, every human being is according to Genesis, made in the image of our Creator, and our own Declaration of Independence recognizes the God-given right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and that should include every single human,
right.
Child born and unborn.
What's amazing is that there are so many people out there supporting folks like, well, every candidate on the left right now, every candidate for the Democrat Party, and people who still support the Democrat Party, even though it seems so completely anti-human. I know, it makes all these pretenses to be for planet Earth and save the environment and take care of everybody. But in fact, it is dehumanizing. Their entire platform is dehumanizing, mainly because, and I suppose the abortion issue is a little bit of a microcosm, a sort of a representation of their valuing of humanity. But they devalue humans because, for instance, their front runner in the last election. Yes, she called them deplorables, half of the people supporting Trump. But she said this. She said you could put them in a basket. That's how they view humans. Shove them in a basket, throw them on a shelf, put them in a grave. I mean, it's, and by the way, the word that she used after deplorables that people tend to forget, which is unfortunate, was irredeemable, meaning of no value. When you have no value, folks, you're as good as dead, because then you're just a drain. So, all right, I've gone off on a complete tangent. Do you want to respond to that, or should we call it a day?
Well, that's it's not necessarily a tangent, and the danger of that then spills over to what about older folks, especially older folks under a government run healthcare system, which is what the Democrats want. And I just yesterday saw where Mayor Bloomberg, one of the Democratic candidates for president, had at some time in the past said, well, you know, we really shouldn't provide life-saving treatment to older people. It's not a good financial decision. So if we don't start having more respect for life and valuing human life as a gift from our Creator. There's a potential for things to get worse, but I want to think that we will overcome that and actually go back and see yep. Roe versus Wade turn in a culture of life.
Right. All right. Don Stenberg, that's my music playing us out. This has been a very lovely conversation. Go pick up Eavesdropping on Lucifer, available now in pre-sale. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. Don't go anywhere. I will be right back after a quick break.
Sam Sorbo.
All righty, welcome back to the program. Hey, so I do want to tell you folks, please go to Homegrown Generation online. So it's homegrowngeneration.com. It is the online family expo. It's for homeschoolers. Their tagline is building a godly legacy one family at a time. It's cheap. It doesn't cost much at all, and you can learn a whole lot from a whole lot of people, experts in the field of mainly home education, but the varying aspects of home education. And so I highly recommend that you go to homegrowngeneration.com, and if for nothing else, come and see me at the end of the week. But they've also got Kirk Cameron, Heidi St. John, Kathy Barnett, Andrew Pudawa, one of my favorites, Israel Wayne, Ginger Hubbard, Todd Wilson, who is funny as all get out. Like, don't miss him because he is certainly very, very entertaining. Lee Bortons will be there. She's the founder of Classical Conversations, which is the homeschooling. In fact, so over the weekend, Kevin and I spoke at a marriage ministry, a marriage conference, I should say. And oh my gosh, it was so much fun. He was just on his game, and we were bantering back and forth. I think the audience really enjoyed it. I know I did. We laughed a lot. And somebody, one of the questions that they asked at the end was, "Are you Classical Conversations?" And of course I am. And she's like, "I knew it." It was very funny. So we can sort of spot each other in a crowd, apparently. But it's not just Classical Conversations. That doesn't work for everybody. Obviously, we are all different. That's what makes it work, right? If we were all the same, then there would be nothing. Because being the same stifles creativity. And so it is in our diversity that we find creativity. And that is a good thing. But the enforced diversity also doesn't work. It's sort of magical. Anyway, I gave you the website, homegrowngeneration.com. And you know what? Go share this with your friends. I'm sure that there's still room to, because it's online. Like, I'm sure they've got tons of room, right? It's internet. Where would they not have room on the internet? So, and I will be speaking this Friday. So please tune in for that. It is interactive. You'll be able to ask questions. I think I have a presentation on Friday where I'll talk about my experiences. And I'm going to expand on my theme because that's just the way that I've been moving recently. In fact, I had an amazing epiphany this morning, and of course, I forgot to write it down. So it's going to, God, you're going to have to bring it back to me again. That's terrible. I don't have enough time to think, much less write stuff down when I do think in the shower, of all places. All right, so I wanted to talk to you quickly about the walkaway, whether it's a hoax. This is a fascinating article by Carlin Borisenko, who's British or from somewhere across the pond. And so she decided that she's a liberal. And so even though she typically writes on the world of work, she decided that she wanted to take a long look in the mirror as somebody on the left and have an honest conversation about what's going on. She says, if you told me 3 years ago that I would ever attend a Donald Trump rally, I would have laughed and assured you, that's never going to happen. And in fact, probably 3 months ago would have been the same thing. She's not English. She's from Manchester, New Hampshire. My bad. I saw Manchester and I just went there. But she says it all started with knitting. And though you might not think of the knitting world as a particularly political community, you'd be dead wrong. She says many knitters are particularly active in social justice communities. Of course, I picture them having knit their own caps with the long side things like sideburns that hang down. You could tie, but you never do. Anyway, she says, as a casual knitter, I never really paid attention to the sort of community social justice warriors and revolutionary roles and all of that. She says she knits as a way to relax, to basically escape the drama of real life, not to engage with it further. But if you've been in the knitting world on Instagram, you'll see it's basically nearly impossible to avoid. There were roving gangs of online social justice warriors starting to go after anyone who was not in lockstep with their ideology and bullying people. Social media bullying. She says one man was attacked and got mobbed so badly he had a nervous breakdown. He was admitted to the hospital on suicide watch. She thought, there's just something that's not right. So many things, actually. Right? With that vitriol. And I've often wondered, like, where does that come from? Like, who are these people that can spew such hatred so easily, so fluidly? She witnessed the amount of hate coming from the left in a small niche knitting community. She started questioning everything. And so she decided to make a proactive effort to break her echo chamber. She decided to listen to voices she thought she disagreed with. She wanted to understand them, their perspective. She wanted to believe that she wanted to confirm that they were filled with hate for anyone who wasn't like them. And she confirmed that that was absolutely not the case. The more she listened to the non-left voices, the more she realized non-lefties are not bad people. They're not racist. They're not Nazis. They're not white supremacists. They had differences of opinions. But just because somebody has a difference of opinion does not make them inherently evil. And in fact, that's one of the big things that I find that as part of the sort of the degradation of our culture is that disagreement is now seen as evil. But is that true? In fact, one of the adages that I have for married people is when you have a dispute, argue the subject matter. Do not argue the person, right? When you attack the individual, it's called an ad hominem attack. It means at the human, at the man. You don't attack the man. First of all, it's just not fair. Well, you're just a nosy nobody. Like, you know, well, so that's an ad hominem. Well, you're just mean. That's ad hominem, right? And it doesn't further the argument. It doesn't further your case. I mean, still don't agree with you. Well, you're just a racist, right? Nope, sorry, still don't agree with you. Still think you're wrong. That hasn't actually approached even convincing me of your point of view. And so she started to discover, or perhaps rediscover, the walk away movement. She says she heard about it when the MSNBC people told her it was fake. It was a bunch of Russian bots. But then she started to meet real people who had been Democrats, who had made the decision to leave the Democrat Party because they couldn't stand the way the leftists were acting. She watched town halls they had held with different minority communities that are all available in their entirety on YouTube, she saw sane, rational discussions from people of all different races, backgrounds, orientations, and experiences. She joined a Facebook group for the community and saw stories popping up daily of people sharing why they are leaving the Democrat Party. It's not fake, she says. Moreover, she says, it felt like a breath of fresh air. There wasn't universal agreement in the group. Some were Trump supporters, some weren't. But they talked and shared their perspectives without shouting, without rage, without cancellation. So then she started questioning everything. I think that that's where we are today as a culture, as a society. I think that we have not a majority, certainly, right? But maybe the tipping point, maybe just enough people who are starting to question everything because they understand that they've been lied to at least once. She says, how is it possible that half of the country is really overtly racist? Is it possible that Trump derangement syndrome is a real thing? Had I been suffering from it for the past 3 years? And her big, big question, did I hate Trump so much that I wanted to see my country fail just to spite him and everyone who voted for him? And so she went to a Trump rally. She said she was nervous. She thought she'd start her day in familiar territory at an MSNBC live show taking place a few blocks away from the rally. She wore her red hat. It looks like a Trump hat, but with a small difference. It says, "Make speech free again." It was a small protest against the cancel culture. The thing is that the hat's completely open to interpretation. So when she wore around left-leaning people, they think that she's talking about the right. But when she's wearing it around right-leaning folks, they think she's talking about the left. And that should serve as a stark reminder of how much our own perspectives and biases play into how we view the world. True. But I also want to point out that it should serve as a reminder that there are still a few things that we both sides value. So she chatted with folks at the MSNBC taping, and she said she was thinking about going to the Trump rally. First, they were fearful for her safety. She'd never seen people she didn't know passionately urge her to avoid the Trump rally people. There was a woman who told her that those people were the lowest of the low. Another man said he'd gone to one of the rallies in the past and had been the target of harassment by large, muscle-bound men. Another woman offered me her pepper spray, she writes. What they didn't know is that they weren't the only ones I'd heard from who were afraid. Some of her more right-leaning friends online expressed genuine fear at my going as well, but not because they were afraid of the attendees. They were afraid of people on the left violently attacking attendees. This was, of course, one day after a man had run his car through a Republican voter registration tent in Florida. So there was genuine fear there'd be a repeat, or Antifa would bus people up from Boston for it, or something. So she was concerned, but she decided to head over an hour and a half before the doors were scheduled to open, 4 hours before Trump was set to take the stage. The line already stretched a mile from the entrance to the arena. So she chatted with folks as she waited. They were so nice. She wasn't harassed. She wasn't intimidated. She never feared for her safety, even for a moment. They were average, everyday people, veterans, school teachers, small business owners, coming from literally all over the place just for the thrill of attending the rally. They were upbeat and excited. She even let it slip that she was a Democrat. You know what the reaction was? Good for you. Welcome. She says inside the air was jubilant. She voted in the New Hampshire Democrat primary for Pete Buttigieg. She genuinely still feels Pete would be great for this country. Maybe he'll have his opportunity in the future. But tomorrow, she's changing her voter registration from Democrat to independent. She's walking away from the party she spent the last 20 years in. She's moving to the middle. She says there are extremes in both parties that I'm uncomfortable with, but also fundamentally believe that most people on both sides are good, decent human beings who want the best for the country. Until we start seeing each other as human beings, there will be no bridging the divide. And so she refuses to be part of the divisiveness any longer. She refuses to hate people she doesn't know simply because they choose to vote for someone else. She says she thinks the Democrats have a butt-kicking coming to them in November. They'll be utterly shocked when it happens because they're existing in an echo chamber that's not reflective of the broader reality. She says she hopes it's a wake-up call. Maybe it'll cause them to take a long look in the mirror and really ask themselves, how did we get here? Maybe then they'll start listening. I tend to doubt it, but I hope they can. I just thought this was such a great piece. It's very hopeful. She's an organizational psychologist and mindfulness expert. She's not religious, clearly. I'm just saying, there's hope out there. Excuse me. And so I'm very, very hopeful about her representing more than just herself. I think that's true. Okay. So I want to go into, I want to talk a little bit about Pelosi, because come on, crazy lady. Nancy Pelosi pre-ripped her State of the Union's pieces of paper. And there's actually a video, and she's like looking around sort of surreptitiously, like, nobody, I'm just sitting here minding my own business. And she takes a piece of paper and she puts it, she takes like three sheets and she puts it sort of below her desk, but not below enough. And so the camera caught it and she ripped it just a tiny little bit, like a centimeter. And then she just puts it back on the desk and puts her hands away. And I didn't, nothing's going on here, folks. So that's Nancy Pelosi. And then she spun it because people were like, whoa, what was that about? Everybody, when she first answered, she said, oh, you know, it's the best that I could do under the circumstances. There was so much worse that I could do than rip the speech. I thought that that would be the best way that I could express myself. And then she confirmed that her desire was actually for attention. She said, oh, I had no intention of doing that when we first went to the State of the Union. In fact, I was well into past the first third of it. I'm a speed reader, so I was reading ahead. She was not. So I knew what was there. I got past about a third of it, and I thought, this is terrible. She then decided, and that's when supposedly, she made a nick in a couple of pages. But she says she made the nicks because she was saying, you ought to remember what was said on this page. And then I realized almost every page had something in it that was objectionable. So no, it wasn't a planned thing. Come on. Well, here, this tells you exactly where she stands on all of this. Sure. This is her during the CNN interview with Christiane Amanpour. Listen.
But when you ask about the, I'm not talking about him personally. I'm just talking about his State of the Union address.
I understand. What about, though, the fact that the president seems liberated? And this is about Democratic politics, so I'm not asking you to criticize here. But he was acquitted. His poll ratings are high.
There was no acquittal. You can't have an acquittal unless you have a trial. And you can't have a trial and you have witnesses and documents. So he can say that.
You have trials all the time without witnesses. And there were documents. In fact, one of the documents that they were waiting on was the document that you eventually sent over. So that was a document. Did she actually say
He was not equipment. There was no equipment. Sorry. Equipment. I shouldn't pick on her. Oh, no, I should.
Acquit it, and the headlines can say acquit it. But he's impeached forever, branded with that, and not vindicated. And
so is Clinton.
Even the senators were saying,
what's
yes,
your point?
It wasn't right.
Yeah, the
but
senators
had the courage to act upon that.
Except
belief.
For?
Yeah, they didn't have the courage to act upon the equipment. Sorry. For shame. It's just pathetic. And it goes to, so that piece that I just read to you, it goes to that because they're so full of vitriol okay. That's all I have to say about Pelosi. There's nothing more for her. Bloomberg's in the news more and more. But I don't think it's good. First, there's a fantastic article up by Sultan Knish, Daniel Greenfeld, who talks about the Democrat nomination and the fact that it's for sale. He writes this, in 2016, Donald Trump proved that money won't buy you the Republican nomination. In 2020, his likely challengers are proving that not only can you buy the Democrat nomination, but it's the best way. Bloomberg's making headlines. He's spending $300 million on advertising to buy third place. Well, it doesn't include the sushi cost and the furniture. $250,000. Six-figure staffer salaries. But he's got $61 billion. It's so fascinating that the Democrats claim to hate billionaires, but two of them successfully bought into the race, Bloomberg and Steyer. Well, they completely lack the populist appeal that propelled Trump to the top. And that's because, folks, Democrats don't care about your vote either. They don't care about your vote. I will say it again. They don't care about your vote as long as they can pretend that you voted the way they want you to. All you have to do is look up the 2008 Democrat, the DNC, and putting God back on the Democrat platform. You will see people vote it down three times, and you will see Villaraigosa, who was the mayor of Los Angeles, and he was sent out to present the confirmation of an upvote, and he just confirmed an upvote, even though more people voted against it than voted for it. What makes a socialist from Vermont and the failed mayor of a Midwestern city competitive? Money. That's all they care about. Well, okay. It's true. He's got billions of dollars, and so he can spend it, and he can buy himself, I guess, a nomination. But there's other stuff in the news that he's into. And it's not very flattering. So this is him from a little while ago. I can't remember. I think it's a few years old. But this is him talking about farming. Why farmers can't work in information technology. Listen.
Anybody, even people in this room, so no offense intended, to be a farmer. It's a process. You dig a hole, you put a seed in, you put dirt on top, add water, up comes the corn. Then we had 300, you could learn that. Then you have 300 okay. years of the...
So he can teach anybody to be a farmer. So Larry Elder sort of took offense at that. He said the agrarian society lasted 3,000 years. And he quotes him saying the agrarian society lasted 3,000 years and we could teach processes... or processes, depending on where you're from. I could teach anybody, even people in this room, no offense intended, to be a farmer. Dwight D. Eisenhower, Larry Elder tweeted a response. Dwight D. Eisenhower wrote, farming looks mighty easy when your plow is a pencil and you're 1,000 miles from the cornfield. And the response to that is really fascinating. My dad, 72, this is BX Haxton 3. My dad, 72, will be harvesting his last crop this spring. I saw a meme a few days ago that listed about 10 things a farmer has to be. A mechanic, economist, chemist, etc. The list doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. It's funny. Carolyn Callie tweeted, now that the true process has been exposed, I'd better not hear any crap about shortages or bad corn crops this year. Farmers had better be able to grow corn like never before. And Echo Bravo tweeted, for a man who built an empire on knowledge, that has to be one of the most ignorant statements I've heard in a long time. Get a clue, Mike. It's ridiculous. But this is a man who is so filled with hubris. I mean, so full of himself. Yeah, he's a billionaire, and he created something that a lot of people needed. But he also is not the smartest, let's say, not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Listen to this. Now, this was just posted, so I'm not sure exactly when this happened, but it's got 1.8 million views already. This was posted by Daybreak Insider. Listen.
This cohort of black and Latino males, age, let's say, 16 to 25, that don't have jobs, don't have any prospects, don't know how to find jobs, don't know what their skill sets are, don't know how to behave in the workplace where they have to work collaboratively.
Okay. That's actually, I just saw, it's from 2011. I don't think that's going to play very well. And so he's going around doing some speaking engagements. And this is, he got heckled recently at Richmond, Virginia. He was heckled by a group of pro-Second Amendment activists. And this was over the weekend. I'm not going to play the first one because they started saying profanity. Don't effing touch me, and because they're trying to be, the people are trying to escort them out. But in this one, you'll hear them chanting. I think it's worth listening to. Some people were happy that the protesters left, obviously, but they made their point there. So it's interesting that it seems like people are more disruptive now than they have been. They're less accommodating. They're sort of closed down. More on that on another show, because I'm running out of time. Dershowitz is now claiming to have proof that Obama asked the FBI to investigate, quote, somebody on behalf of George Soros. This is out of the Washington Examiner, of all places. He's the Harvard law professor, Alan Dershowitz, who is basically, he's intellectually honest. He's not afraid of the right. He is left, but he's not as far left as some. He was speaking with Breitbart News in an interview that aired on Sunday. He's an impeachment attorney for the president. And so that's, he says, I have some information as well about the Obama administration, which will be disclosed in a lawsuit at some point. I'm not prepared to disclose it now, about how President Obama personally asked the FBI to investigate someone on behalf of George Soros, who was a close ally of his. And to that, my daughter said, Professor Dershowitz shot himself accidentally in the back of the head next week. I'm just saying. All right. That's all my time that I have today. Please go to homegrowngeneration.com to join the online family expo. Make sure you register so you can see me on Friday. I'm looking forward to that. And also go pick up a copy of my book, True Faith. It's out now. It launched over the weekend, so go get your copy. And by all means, if you enjoy it, don't forget to post a review. This is Sam Sorbo for The Sam Sorbo Show. Thanks so much for joining me. Go have a great rest of your day.
General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.